Okay, welcome everybody who's listening to this recording. This is the Mises Academy class for Principles of Economics. This is the spring 2012 edition, and this is the office hours for week 7, when we covered drug prohibition this week in the main lecture. Now, I have somebody, Susan Brown, had emailed me some questions saying she wouldn't be able to tune in live, so I'm going to answer those, and then I'm going to talk a little bit more about one particular argument when it comes to drug legalization that I think the standard libertarian position is wrong, and so it was a little bit too subtle for me to get into in the main lecture, but since we've got this block of time here, and I imagine the people who tune in the office hours are the overachievers, I'll cover that here. As of this moment, unless I'm reading this readout improperly, I think no one is tuned in live to these office hour sessions. I offer them at different times of the day to try to cater to different groups of people, and it seems like if it's too early on a Saturday, or if the weather's nice, people have better things to do. So anyway, this unless somebody shows up and starts asking me other questions, this recording is not going to be a full hour. I'll just go for maybe 20, 25 minutes to answer Susan Brown's questions and then make that little technical point that I mentioned, and then I'll wrap it up. Okay, so Susan had emailed me. She said, when you talked about paying off government officials, did that include lawmakers? If the public would actually demand that drug prohibition be lifted, could it ever really happen? The drug bosses would surely pay off lawmakers to keep prohibition. Was that an obstacle to ending alcohol prohibition? And if so, was that effort a model that could be followed to end drug prohibition? Okay, so that's a really good question. So first of all, what's she talking about? When I talked about paying off government officials, I made the point in the main lecture and in the textbook, of course, that the way the system works right now, the only reason we have such rampant drug dealing and usage, despite these ostensibly very severe penalties, is that, of course, the government doesn't actually enforce them all with draconian fidelity on anybody that a government official sees as a drug dealer. All right, so that's how those two things can exist simultaneously. And specifically what happens, why the government officials do that is because they get paid off, right? And I made the point that it's not like a random occasional thing where once in a while a police officer sees some drug deal happening and then goes up to the guy and says, hey, I can take you in right now unless you make it worth my while, and he gives him a $100 bill or something. No, it is a systematic thing where, there's a regularly scheduled drop of money from the drug dealers to, various police officers and paying off judges and stuff like that. All right, so it's much more systematic than probably most Americans realize, even if they are skeptical of the drug war. I think just the amount of corruption would be staggering to most people. I think the thing that epitomizes it for me is that there are documented cases where drug lords will smuggle like cocaine into a Chicago airport, on a private flight, obviously not flying commercially. And then when they land there, the issue is how do you get the many kilos of cocaine that have, they're worth whatever, hundreds of thousands of dollars, depending on how much you have, in street value once you cut it up and everything. That's risky. You don't want to be just walking around with that in your bag because you can get mugged. Somebody knows who you are. You're walking around with a bullseye on you, and you can't hire an armored car because that draws attention, and technically what you're doing is highly illegal, so you got to be discreet. And so what do? They get police officers, Chicago police officers, to drive them around, perhaps even in actual police vehicles. And that part I'm not sure of. I do know that there were DEA stings to arrest Chicago police officers for escorting drug dealers around. Like they were the people driving them around to safely transport them and their cocaine to wherever they were going. But I don't know off the top of my head if they were doing it in a Chicago police cruiser or if they were doing it in Mumbai. They probably were, because that's the whole point. The reason they do that, it's not that a Chicago police officer, you know, knows kung fu or something or has magical mutant powers. It's that they're a police officer, and so no one's going to mess with them. You know, other criminals are not going to remember the scene, if you saw the movie, The Usual Suspects, the opening, one of the opening scenes when they're trying to explain why this guy Verbal was so clever and how they, you know, they robbed those police officers. Remember that scene? I mean, that was so audacious because you typically criminals don't attack the police. That's just crazy. Because the police is, however else you want to describe them, the biggest and most powerful gang around. So however, you know, the mafia can't take the police on because there's thousands of police officers. The mafia has, you know, depending on the family you're talking about, 30 or 40 soldiers, so to speak. The police have thousands. And the police have, of course, the public support, and they can get millions of dollars in funding. If there was actually a war between the police and the organized crime, and various people were getting shot on both sides, and the police commissioners went on TV and said, hey, we need double the funding in order to beat these guys, they would be able to do it. The public would say, oh, sure. Whereas, you know, the crime bosses couldn't go to all the people who gamble in their establishments, you know, hidden, and they take the cut of the money and say, hey, we need you guys to gamble more because we're fighting the cops. I mean, that wouldn't, they couldn't just double their revenue that way. All right, so my point is, sometimes you get the wrong image from watching mob movies and things, that the mafia runs the show and the police are subservient to them, but that's not really accurate. The police at any moment could shut down the mafia if they wanted to. They don't, because why would they? The mafia provides them a stream of revenue. So what happens is the police in practice allow certain organized criminal groups to do all of these illegal business things because they're good. They're very profitable, all right, and then they get a cut of it. And so the police act as a cartel organization, or rather, they enforce the cartels. So anyway, I'm just saying that's the degree of systematic corruption that I think a lot of Americans don't realize. Even Americans who are for drug legalization, just because they think, oh, come on, marijuana doesn't hurt anybody. This is crazy. I think a lot of them don't even realize just how systematic it is. Okay, so back to Susan's question. She said, so when we're talking about these streams of payments from organized criminals to government officials, does that include lawmakers? I imagine it does. I can't say with certainty, though, that, like, in terms of my own research on the topic. In other words, I am dead certain that there was rampant corruption and that the narcotics divisions of major urban areas, police enforcement, you know, in other words, like the Chicago PD or the NYPD or the LAPD, the portion of their police force that deals with enforcing drug laws, I'm quite confident that the people on those in those jobs get paid off by drug dealers. But I'm not as confident as to say, like, the average senator, does he actually get money directly from the mafia? I don't know. I mean, in other words, I haven't read enough biographies or true crime stories or things like that, memoirs written by an ex-mafia guy, that kind of stuff, to know about that. Whereas I do know, having read those kind of things, you know, true crime stories and whatever, that the police officers get paid off. There's a thing called a famous economics, I don't know what you want to call it, genre or something, concept called Baptists and bootleggers. Right? So Baptist, like, you know, the church, the, you know, Christian sect of Baptists. And then bootleggers are, of course, people who would make alcohol illegally. And what that refers to, you know, some economists had the classic paper talking about Baptists and bootleggers and set up this model of the world in terms of political economy, and then others, you know, have applied that concept subsequently to different areas. So in economics, there's this thing called, oh yeah, that's the Baptist and bootleggers effect, or you say, oh yeah, that's another example of Baptist and bootleggers. So the term has become more generic to apply just to this concept. So what does it mean, Baptist and bootleggers? Was talking about alcohol prohibition and saying it was hard to get rid of it, and there was support for alcohol prohibition coming from two rival camps. The Baptists, meaning like the religious folk who thought alcohol was from the devil, and that in a just society that was godly, we wouldn't even tolerate people selling alcohol, and that it should be a crime. And then also the supporters of were the bootleggers, because they knew, so the people who had a lot of market share under alcohol prohibition, who were making money hand over fist, they didn't want it to be legalized because they knew they would get displaced, right? And that's really the thing, and that a lot of people don't understand that. A lot of people think that the current drug dealers would be the biggest proponents of drug legalization, right? Because at first that sounds reasonable. You'd say, well, if my job right now has me getting, you know, risking going to prison for 30 years every day I go to work, wouldn't I like a change in the law so that now what I'm doing is legal? Wouldn't that be awesome? But actually, no. I mean, that might be true for some people, like young people who are just peddling marijuana or something because they like it, and you know, just it's a convenient way to make money on the side, and they would rather be able to smoke it and not risk any legal ramifications. But the people who are millionaires, like the major drug kingpins, their whole empire is founded on prohibition, right? They would be nobodies if cocaine were legalized, right? They wouldn't be in charge. They wouldn't be on top of that industry if major pharmaceutical companies could get into it the way that they, you know, just like the major drug dealers, the drug kingpins who smuggle stuff in from Colombia, right now they don't have a lot of market share in aspirin or in cold medicine, right? Because they're actually not good commercial business people. It's that they're savvy and they're pretty good business people. If you're looking at the group of humans who are willing to kill people and who are willing to risk going to prison for 50 years and who don't mind working in an area where at any moment when they start their car, it might explode, right? So that's a much smaller group of people than just all entrepreneurs. So the drug kingpins who are on top right now, they're good businessmen in a much smaller sample of people who have all those other attributes. And they would not be on top of the market if it were a legitimate enterprise. They would not be able, they would go out of business. Okay, so Susan is totally right that the drug lords and, you know, organized crime and so forth have a vested interest in maintaining the drug laws as they are. Because again, think about what's happening is, if you are in a position where you're paying off government officials, effectively what's happening is all the government's prisons and thousands of people with guns and all the goodwill they have with the public who will call in and report, there's people dealing drugs on the corner by my house, come stop them. All of that apparatus is being harnessed to knock out your competitors if the government actually gives a nod and a wink and lets you keep doing it, as long as you're discreet about it and you do it in certain areas and, you know, you don't do it in front of a church and outrage the public, right? So that you are benefiting. It's like you've harness that whole government apparatus of coercion to prevent people from competing with you. So to legalize it would mean now all of a sudden the government's going to pull back its guns and prisons and so forth and say, hey, anyone who wants to sell this, go ahead. So the market price is going to crash, and now there's going to be on every corner not just guys peddling it out of their trench coat, but there's going to be in the stores. You know, there'll be people, major companies selling name brand products in packaging. You know, maybe you have to have a prescription or something. I mean, they probably just wouldn't go full bore, total legalization. But the point is, you're not going to be able to compete with that. And you can't use your armed thugs to go in if it's in all the CVSs across the nation, you know, an organized crime family with 50 people with guns can't take on CVS across the nation. That's just not going to happen. You know, they might control certain areas and get the CVS people to not mess with them in certain neighborhoods of New York and Chicago and L.A., but they're not going to be able to keep it out of all the suburbs. And then the customers, the people who want to buy those drugs, are just going to go to wherever it's cheaper and highest quality. And so those organized crime families are going to, you know, their market's going to dry up instantly. Okay, so they would be very much opposed to it. And so Susan is right. I think that with drug I use the term drug prohibition, but it's the war on some drugs, there would be that obstacle that you would not be able to, the part of the problem of trying to legalize heroin and cocaine and marijuana would come from two sources. Again, the Baptist and the bootleggers effect. That the right-wing social conservatives would flip out and say, what, are you crazy? Do you know what that's going to do if we legalize this stuff? But ironically, another main opponent would be the organized crime that is right now making millions, billions of dollars a year off of this stuff. And what's funny is, in terms of behind the scenes, I mean, so it'd be the two-pronged effect. The public rationale for keeping it illegal would be the religious, you know, morality stuff. It's not like some senator would get up there and say, I'm going to vote to keep this illegal because I'm getting paid off $100,000 a year and I don't want to lose that. He's not going to say that. He's going to say, because we want to keep kids clean and look at the statistics showing the progress we're making in reducing drug addiction. But in terms of behind the scenes, what actually would be motivating the votes, it arguably could be more the payoffs they're getting, because it's not like a church is going to have a collection and raise money from its members and then pay Congress and say, hey, if you keep it illegal, we'll send you, you know, we'll donate this much to your campaign. That's not going to be that big of a deal. You know, so in terms of the monetary bribery going on, that's going to come from the organized crime. The issue of how does the public opinion matter? It's more, well, you're going to lose your reelection if you vote a certain way and the public is totally opposed to what you did. So, but having said all that, I mean, alcohol prohibition did go away despite this so-called Baptist and bootleggers effect that FDR, again, one of the few decent things he did, was legalized. So why did that happen? I haven't studied it too much, but I think one of the main things was the government was broke. Remember that he did it in 1933, and it was, you know, the height of the Great Depression. The economy was awful. Government had been running what at the time were unprecedented peacetime budget deficits. And Roosevelt's plan for fixing the economy called for spending gobs more money. And I think part of what it was is they said, well, you know, if we legalize it, we can tax it, and we'll get a lot more revenue that way. And also it will, you know, and I think they probably also had some vague understanding of the fact that it would help the economy, actually, if they, you know, opened up that whole market. So, and incidentally, Mark Thornton has done a lot of work on this. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I kind of think Thornton, I'm almost positive he has said, because if you, some people will look at the statistics of like when FDR took the U.S. off the gold standard, because that was one of the first things he did also. And, yeah, and so if you look at various statistics, the U.S. actually, by some measures, seemed to be recovering from like 33, 34 to 37. I mean, it was still awful, but it actually looked like it was on the road to recovery, and then there was another slump again in 37, 38. And so a lot of Keynesians say, oh, you know what that is? That's because Roosevelt, thank goodness, took us off that barbarous relic and got us off gold, whereas Mark Thornton, I think, has made the argument that, well, another major policy move that Roosevelt did when he first came into office was to get rid of alcohol prohibition. And so you know, it's not clear what was driving, you know, this. That would be a huge thing if you subscribe to the, you know, the economic literature saying about the evils of drug prohibition. So anyway, I had actually stuck my neck out a couple of years ago saying I thought Obama was going to really pull back on the drug war for the same reason. I thought that the federal government was going to be hurting so much for money and the state and local governments were going to be hurting so much because they're collapsing tax revenue and everything from this awful, I think it's the second Great Depression, that I thought they were going to, I mean, they might not do full bore legalization, but I thought they were going to really open up the medical marijuana and just, you know, maybe keep the stuff illegal on the books, but just really pull back on the enforcement to make it de facto legal. But the Obama administration didn't do that, at least so far they haven't. They actually really stepped up enforcement, even like in California, where at the state and local level, they had really been moving towards tolerance and liberalization. And the feds were coming in and actually doing things that the local officials were like, what are you doing? You can't, you know. So my prediction on that was wrong, unfortunately. And I don't know, I'm not sure what pushed that. So anyway, that's okay. And then Susan asks, can you discuss your next course, the anatomy of the Fed, how much workload should be anticipated with that course compared to this one? The workload per se will be about the same, I would think. So there will be some assigned readings, but I think on average it would be more than it was in this course. However, the reading would be more difficult than it is in this course. Okay, so the number of hours per week you have to devote to is probably the same, but the anatomy of the Fed, I mean, we get into, I don't want to intimidate people away from it, but it's, you know, keep in mind, this Econ 101 class, I'm teaching, it's designed for people who have never taken economics before, and I know that there are some homeschooling sixth graders who might be hearing these lectures. And the textbook was written with a sort of junior high audience as the focus, where the anatomy of the Fed, I'm thinking most of the audience is going to be adults. Right? So if you're a high school student, you want to take it, it's not I'm going to use vocabulary, you won't know what it means, but I'm just saying I'm going to be referring to things like balance sheets and stuff like that and going through the accounting and when the Fed buys $1 billion in assets, how does that happen? You know, like, where does the money come from? You know, we're going to be going over mechanics like that because that's, you know, the name of the course, The Anatomy of the Fed, is we want to open the hood up and really see how does this thing work so we understand this monster and beyond just generalities like, oh, it prints money and pays for wars and stuff like that that people wouldn't want to pay taxes for. I mean, that's all true, but we're really going to get the nuts and bolts and see the anatomy of the Fed and go through things like its organizational structure and, you know, is it really the case that Ben Bernanke can decide on monetary policy? So, well, no, actually, technically, there's, you know, the Board of Governors and this and that and how are they picked and is it true that, you know, I've heard that the Fed is a private entity. Is that true that it has shareholders? It's not really a government agency. We're going to go through all that kind of stuff and see, you know, the sense in which the Fed is a government agency, but also the sense in which it's a pseudo-private organization, that the Fed is not really just like the IRS or the EPA. The Fed is kind of unique in its organizational structure. So we're going to be going over stuff like that. So like I say, it's not like I'm going to be giving you 100 pages of reading per week, but the reading will be on stuff like the organizational structure of the Fed, which is a little bit drier than talking about the demand for gasoline. So I won't assume, how can I put it, if you've taken this course, it's not like you would need a prerequisite in order to take the anatomy of the Fed class. At least I can say that. That it's not like I'm going to be assuming the people in that course will have learned concepts from elsewhere and you're going to be lost because you didn't take that other background material. But I am saying the concepts and stuff that we're going to be studying will be a little bit more difficult to grasp than the stuff we're doing in this principles course. Okay, let me just check and see. I still think I'm the only one logged in. Okay, so let me just very briefly for like the next 5 minutes or so, let me just mention this distinction I had talked about, a problem I think with the standard libertarian argument for drug legalization. All right, so a lot of times if you're reading a quick argument from a libertarian perspective as, you know, from a free market economics libertarian perspective as to why the drug war is ineffective, you know, they'll go over sort of principled arguments saying, hey, it's my body. If I want to do something that doesn't directly violate somebody else's property right, the government has no business telling me what I can or can't do. That if you grant that, then they can tell me what books I can read. Or they could tell me what religion I should have. If you're conceding the premise that the government can override my decisions as to what is healthy for my body, okay? So there's that. But then they'll go into the pragmatic arguments, and one of the big things, of course, is this issue of violence. And they'll say, just like I did in my lecture, look, it's clear there's this relationship between gang warfare and drug prohibition. Just like alcohol in the 1920s under prohibition, you had gangland shootings, Al Capone and so forth, and rival gangs. Once you legalize alcohol, there's no more fighting over alcohol. So people still get in car accidents, people still get drunk and go get into bar fights and kill people, you know, guys beat their husbands and stuff if they're drunk. But at least you don't have guys with machine guns shooting each other over who gets to sell beer in this neighborhood, or whiskey or whatever, which you did have when alcohol was illegal. And so there's that clear correlation, and then the conclusion, of course, is if we legalize heroin and cocaine and marijuana, we might have to deal with people ending up in the hospital from overdoses and stuff, and that's a separate argument. And it's true, if you are just morally offended by the fact that your neighbor is using heroin, that's still going to happen, but at least you're not going to have 12-year-old kids getting killed in crossfire in the inner city from drug dealers taking each other out. And at least you're not going to have huge, literally, you know, mini wars between the Colombian government and drug gangs, and drug gangs kidnapping people and all that. You know, that stuff would all go away almost overnight if we legalized these hard drugs, just like it disappeared once we legalized alcohol in the United States. So that's all fine. I have no problem with those statements. The problem I have, though, is when a typical proponent of this perspective tries to explain why is it that under prohibition there's more violence. And one of the standard arguments that I, you know, used to hear all the time, and I just accepted, you know, without thinking twice about it, and then lately, it was actually when I was writing the lessons for the Young Economist, when I really thought through it, and I realized that, no, that's a bad argument. That has nothing to do with it. And so what you will often hear from a sort of free market libertarian drug legalization perspective is they'll say something like, oh, the reason that you see more violence when it's prohibited is that if somebody robs me and I'm a drug dealer, I can't call the police. Right? So they'll say the reason if these drug dealers, you know, they're meeting in a parking garage at 2 a.m. and they both pull their cars up and pop the trunks and they get out and there's guys in one car with a bunch of guns and guys in the other car with a bunch of guns and they're swapping. One guy has suitcases full of cash and the other car has bags full of cocaine. and they're meeting in this parking garage or whatever. And so the argument is that will often lead to a gun battle where one group will shoot and kill everybody in the other group, and then they'll take the drugs and the money. And they'll say, why is that? And they'll say, oh, because they can't call the police for protection. If you get robbed, you can't just call up the police and say, hey, he took my cocaine, because it's cocaine. You can't do that. And so they're explaining the prevalence of violence in the prohibited industry by reference to the fact that you lack police protection. So that might make sense if you're a minarchist, but I'm saying that makes no sense if you're a Rothbardian, or just more generally an anarcho-capitalist, that what you're saying is it's the reason violence flourishes in a prohibited industry is not because of what the government is doing that's bad, it's because you're saying the government is refraining from enforcing its monopoly on force that you as an anarchist think is bad also. So that's kind of a weird position to be taking. That you're saying, oh, the reason we have so much violence here is we don't have this institution of guys who get paid through taxation coming and using their guns in this situation. If only they would come and point their guns at these criminals and keep them at bay, then there'd be less violence in the world. And that seems like a really weird thing for an anarcho-capitalist in the Rothbardian strain to say. So what I think is more is actually the correct thing is to say, no, it's because of the drug prohibition that sets that up. It's not the lack of government guns causing violence. Because look, we can look at the government doesn't protect much property rights in the inner city in general. So if some dry cleaner, and I know this, like my car got broken into when I lived in Chicago. I lived in a bad area just because I just graduated from undergrad and I was getting ready to go to NYU. And I was working for 6 months or so in the meantime. And so I was poor, and I lived in a real seedy area town, and I had a CD player in my truck, and one morning I go out there, and my window was broken in, and my CD player was gone. So not knowing what to do, I called the cops, and they didn't do anything. I don't mean merely that they didn't find the person. I mean, they just, like, took down the information and said, okay, somebody will be out there, and then nobody ever even came. I mean, it's not like the police were assigning 3 detectives to my case. They didn't care. They just probably noted it in the crime statistics. And for all I know, it didn't even show up in the crime statistics. Maybe that would make them look bad. Right? So my point is that if you're like a dry cleaner and you're running, you're like a play on stereotypes here, but I've seen this stuff. You, like a Chinese dry cleaner, or you're selling Chinese food or something, and you're in an area where there's an inner city area where the people there are not too friendly towards you, you're not safe because of the police. The police aren't going to drive in there and pull guys off of you if you're getting robbed. And they're not. It would take them a half an hour to get there anyway. What you do is you put in bulletproof glass and you do all kinds of things to protect yourself, and you run your business in a certain way to try to minimize the chance of you being robbed at gunpoint. You're not safe because of the police. All right, so and the thing is, it's not, though, that because there's no police protection, that's why we see so much violence associated with the laundromat business, or that's why the Chinese takeout restaurants, go hand-in-hand with gang warfare. I mean, and that we see gangs running Chinese laundromats. See what I'm saying? That's not what happens. Yes, yeah, so occasionally those places are robbed, but it's not that we associate the industry itself with violence the way we associate cocaine dealing with violence. So it's not merely that cocaine dealers once in a while get robbed. It is that industry itself is inherently violent. And so what I'm saying is that's because of what the government is doing. It's because the government goes out with its guns and uses its guns to punish people who are caught dealing cocaine. So what I'm saying is, to explain the violence in the drug trade, to me, you don't explain it by pointing to the unwillingness of the government to use their guns, namely to protect drug dealers from being robbed by other private people. Rather, I explain the violence in the drug trade by the government's use of its guns, by the fact that it goes around and certain people who are drug dealers it will take and put them in a dungeon. And if they try to run away, they'll shoot them. All right? So that's the way I would explain it. And just to think through that, the only reason those guys who are swapping suitcases full of cash and cocaine in big duffel bags, the only reason they're meeting in a parking garage at 2 a.m. is that it's illegal for them to be doing that transaction. If they weren't in any danger of getting caught and being convicted of dealing cocaine, they wouldn't do it in a parking garage at 2 a.m. with suitcases full of cash. That's crazy. Of course you're asking to get shot if you're going to do that. You're increasing the marginal benefits of someone shooting you if you're walking around with $2 million in cash in a suitcase. Rather, what they would do is they'd do what the Chinese laundromat or the Chinese takeout place does. They would rent a storefront, have a bunch of bulletproof glass, have cameras and stuff like that, have armored cars to come and go, and they would do transactions like that, and they wouldn't keep a bunch of cash on them. They would do much smaller purchases, right? They wouldn't have someone bring $2 million worth of cocaine in one fell swoop. That's crazy. You're just asking for someone to shoot you. They would do things much more rationally and safely and minimize the target, the bullseye that's sitting on their head. Okay, but they can't do that now. The reason a drug dealer in the inner city, so that's what I'm trying to say. It's wrong to think, oh, the police just don't even care about the inner city and they don't enforce any of the laws in there. If that were really true, if what we were trying to understand was the implication of an absence of government using its guns, there wouldn't be all this massive gang warfare because you would just, the rival drug dealers would just rent a storefront, put in bulletproof glass, and you wanted to buy some cocaine, and you would go in there, and you would buy $5 worth. And so it's not worth shooting somebody over $5. And there would be, you know, and the money going in would be in a safe vault and everything. It would just be like there's not gang warfare involved with banks, even though banks are sitting on a bunch of money. But it wouldn't even be like that. It would be like with a regular drugstore like that sells aspirin and cold medicine. You wouldn't keep $2 million in cash in the vault. Every day you'd send it to the bank. So that would be de facto legalization, and there wouldn't be rampant warfare. The reason you have the warfare is that the government is more than happy to use its guns, and it uses it all the time. And it patrols the streets, the inner city, and if it catches somebody dealing drugs, it has the option of arresting them. That's why the street price is so high. Because they know, the dealers know, if the police feel like it, they can put us in jail at any time. And so that has to keep the street price high, and only people who pay off the cops and whatever and stay on their good side are the ones that would risk and can flourish doing that. And that's what keeps the street price high, and that's what gives it a target for violence. So anyway, I'll wrap it up there. But again, what I'm trying to say is to warn you, a lot of times a typical argument in the case for drug legalization coming from a free market libertarian perspective is to say, oh, the reason there's so much violence in the drug trade is that when these things are black market goods, there's no legal protection for that. And I'm saying that is an odd argument to make if you're an anarchist, because you think that the market can provide protection for goods and services and can enforce contracts and minimize violence and theft, and you think the government monopoly on law enforcement is itself inefficient and a source of injustice. So it's weird to say part of what's bad about the drug war is the government doesn't give its benevolent services of law of property and protection for the valuable property of drug dealers. And that's why the drug dealers now are vulnerable. Oh, if only the government would come and protect me with their guns. No, the drug dealers can hire tons of guys with guns. And they're not crying because the government cop won't come and save them from a mugging. The reason the drug dealers are vulnerable is because the government's out there with its guns locking up drug dealers. And that's what makes that industry inherently very dangerous, and that's what arms the drug dealers, right? So it's the government that's bringing guns into the industry, and so we shouldn't be surprised that this agency has thousands of employees coming in all heavily armed, that in the new equilibrium, the private people who are still in the industry end up being armed also. It's not, that's the cause and effect. The government is the one introducing violence into this trade. That's the, you know, they call it the drug war. We shouldn't be surprised if the government declares war on a certain group of people, that over time, whoever's left in that group is going to be heavily armed. Because that's what happens when you pick a war with somebody. They start fighting back. Okay, I'll stop there. Have a good Saturday, everybody.